Welcome to the Tenet Podcast. I'm Todd Pearson here with my friend and partner, Wes Brown.
Hey, Todd. It's good to see you again. It's been like a week.
I know,
Last time it was like 3 days. Now it's a week. I've missed you.
I missed you too, buddy.
But the weather is beautiful outside.
It was a stunning weekend. Yeah. I know that you got up in the hills and enjoyed the fall colors. And I got out on a hike with my wife.
At a secret location that can't be disclosed. We had this big, long discussion about this, Anna. So anyway, sorry, I digress. So by all means, Todd, it's good to see you.
We hiked up in the Black Hawk area, for those that want to know. We have a great episode this week. Our guest is Anna Kay. Anna currently has a solo show at Sandra Phillips Gallery here in Denver, Colorado. It's called Heat Wave, featuring her charcoal drawings, her watercolor paintings, projections, and video. And she also helped curate and organize a show called Pink Progressions Collaborations that's currently at the Arvada Center through November 8th of this year. And 5280 recognized her as one of the Colorado artists that you should be collecting now. I thought that was a pretty incredible endorsement. Anna, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having me here.
Thanks for taking time out of your evening to spend with us goofballs.
Yeah, we're really excited. I was perusing your website earlier and oh my God, you have some skills. That's awesome. Beautiful stuff.
Thank you.
Pretty stunning. For those that are listening, if you can stomach through this first 5 minutes of us being goofballs, if you go to her website, it's annakayart.com, annakaye art.com. Check it out while you're listening to this, and you'll see some stunning charcoal drawings, some beautiful watercolors, and some other amazing things on our website. Anna, tell us about this solo show that you have that's currently at the Sandra Phillips Gallery.
So the exhibition is a part of my larger series, which is Wildfire. And I've been exploring wildfire since 2007. So I have the charcoals and the watercolor and projection and video in the exhibition. And it's titled Heat Wave, which is based on a large scale drawing in the show. It's a zoomed in view of fire. So it looks like an abstraction, but it's based on fire. And I've taken the reds, yellows, and oranges out of the drawing. So it's black and white. And this emphasizes the creative aspects of fire. Fire is an important part of our ecosystems. It's been a part of our landscapes for thousands of years, since the beginning of terrestrial plants. So Heat Wave explores the hope, resilience, and regeneration that occurs as a result of these intense alterations.
Have you always had an infatuation with nature?
Yeah, I have.
And I was going to say, you speak of this from authority because you got your degree in, was it geology?
Yeah, I went to Skidmore College and I love science and art. So I ended up graduating with a Bachelor of Science in both geology and fine art.
Wow, that's impressive.
One of my first classes was natural disasters. We did learn about wildfires in that class. And the class was kind of like a natural disaster for me. It was freshman year. I was adjusting to a new way of academic life, and it was tough, but I ended up creating really strong friendships with the professors because continued on taking geology courses and graduating with my degree and developing a passion for geology and science in general.
Yeah, that's neat. I had the same experience in college. It's like, I went to college when I was 29, but I made lifelong friends with a number of the professors, and I ended up working for one later. But we've been friends since the early 90s. So yeah, you do. You meet some really great people and make really strong bonds. So that's neat.
Yeah.
So in addition to these charcoal drawings, what else are people going to see if they come to the gallery?
The show has realistic pieces, and it also includes some abstraction, but I'm mostly known for my hyper-realistic drawings. And Wes mentioned the photo realism, when people come into the show, they think it's a photograph, but it's actually a drawing. And I even create drawings and paintings that look like photographs without photographs. It's just my natural style and my natural approach. I was heavily influenced by photography at a young age too. So my aunt Eileen was a photographer and she gave us her photography equipment. So we had a basement with a dark room. And my sister and I would create photographs in high school and in college using that dark room space. So early on, I was influenced and I just naturally approached my drawings and paintings that way. I also really love every little detail. I love all the imperfections because I don't view them as imperfections. I view them as all important parts of the whole. Every angle, tiny detail, value, or color is an important part. And I also have a hard time filtering out information. So it all goes in there.
Well, you definitely can tell. I mean, you have some zoomed in detailed shots of some of these drawings on your website. And I was like, wow, the detail is just phenomenal. I mean, and these drawings, they're mesmerizing. I mean, they're just absolutely stunning. You know, I'm looking at your drawing that's entitled Fireline. And it's, I feel like when I'm looking at some of these drawings, it's like when I'm camping and I'm actually looking, standing around, looking into the campfire. Like there's something that just draws you in and it's kind of romantic, even though it's this force of nature that, you know, destroying, but also it's a rebirth of sorts as well, right?
Right. And that's what I like to emphasize is the rebirth and the survival and regeneration.
Well, in fact, the redwoods, isn't it? They require fire to reproduce, if I remember right. That actually the fire is what opens up the pine cones to release the seed for them to grow new saplings.
Yeah, exactly. I actually spent some time in Kings Canyon and Sequoia National Park, and I watched a controlled burn of a sequoia tree. And it was crazy just watching those flames travel up that tree. So the little green pine cones are so tiny compared to the tree, because the tree is huge. But the pine cones are tiny and they contain a ton of seeds, but the seeds won't come out of the pine cone unless it gets fire or unless insects get to it. And that fire helps to bring those pine cones down from the crown of the tree to the floor, and then it opens it up.
So, you know, in that instance, in that ecosystem, fire is required for rebirth, like you said. So that's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's required here in Colorado too. We have a lot of species that are adapted for fire.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, you know, that, you know, not to dwell on fire and especially now, but it's really interesting to go back to an area that had been burned out. I just took a hike down in Hell's Canyon, and that burned out in the early 2000s. And just the growth that's there, you know, there's still a lot of dead trees and everything, but the growth has come back on the, you know, on the surface, and it's just beautiful in its own right.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's amazing to see all the growth that comes back, especially if the fire isn't too severe, and it comes back a lot more quickly. Mm-hmm. I've witnessed fires out where I live in the Green Mountain area, and I go see what happens in the spring after that fire, and sometimes I can't even find the fire. It's just covered with wildflowers and grass and shrubs.
It's pretty amazing. So you've been exploring this since 2007, is that what you said?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what made you decide to... what was the catalyst for you to decide to explore fire?
So I am from Detroit, the Metro Detroit area. And growing up there, I witnessed vast urban decay from deindustrialization, crime, and other factors, as well as racial segregation. Through this experience, I developed a heightened sense of empathy and justice. And it's a crazy history for Detroit. Beginning in the 1950s, Detroit's auto industry moved out of the city, and that caused a lot of the adverse economic effects. At one point, abandoned lots made up more than half of total residential lots in large portions of the city. With at least 70,000 abandoned buildings, 31,000 empty houses, and 90,000 vacant lots. To me, when I would go through the city, it would look like a tornado went through it. And another significant part, it's October. The night before Halloween was Devil's Night. And it was a night when people would set buildings and dumpsters on fire. And vandalism in this way on Devil's Night was prevalent from the 1970s to the 1990s. The worst year was 1984 when firefighters responded to more than 800 blazes that covered the entire city in an eerie smoke on Halloween morning. Things have changed since then. It's gotten better. But that's and good. I thought everybody had Devil's Night. But no, I moved. I've lived in other states like New York and Missouri and here Colorado. And I know other states have experienced similar Devil's Night, but Detroit's was in particular violent. So moving away from Michigan, I realized, oh, wow, this was a night where we stayed in to get away from the fires. And like I said, for Detroit, things have changed since then, and they're experiencing a revitalization and an economic resurgence, which is amazing. And
so just like a forest fire.
Right, exactly. Yep, yep. I was also influenced by a few of travels that I did with, one of them was with my father. I graduated from high school and we went to visit Mount St. Helens. Mount St. Helens experienced the volcanic explosions and pyroclastic flows in 1980. That was the year that I was born.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was considered one of the most disastrous volcanic eruptions in the United States history. So when I went to visit Mount St. Helens, I did experience that eerie gray landscape. But in the midst of that landscape, I also saw a herd of deer and tons of fireweed. Fireweed is a beautiful pink wildflower. It's called fireweed because it's often first to grow in areas burned by fire. It was one of the first plants to appear after the eruption of Mount St. Helens in 1980. You can find fireweed also in Colorado. And the cool thing about that flower being a first colonizer after these devastating events occur is they're filled with nutrients. They're filled with vitamins A and C. And and the shoots make tasty spring vegetables. And they also can make tea with the leaves, and it also makes delicious honey, jelly, and syrup. So I just love the concept of this plant that first comes out after that disaster to then replenish the landscape and provide nutrients to animals.
That is amazing.
Yeah, I actually graduated high school in 1980 in South Dakota, and we even experienced some of the ash that far away. So, I mean, it really had an impact on everything east of Mount St. Helens as well. So, yeah, that was a huge, huge event.
Yeah, and I don't know, growing up with my family, there was always this heightened sense of weather and storms. So exciting when a storm came. And I've loved them ever since. But again, it's that kind of love-fear relationship because you don't know how heavy the rain is going to be or if there's going to be hail or right. If the wind is going to create damage. But for me, it's just, you know, a time when the earth then becomes replenished with rain. And I love the sounds and sensations that occur when the wind is high during a storm and it makes everything look alive. The trees move and you hear them and the grass, everything around you is moving. So you hear it all. Throughout my life, I've been drawn to these eerie experiences that where nature makes you feel small, but where nature also becomes so sublime and powerful.
I think in this day and age, we kind of take it for granted. We feel safe in our little houses in suburbia, and you get out in the wild or you experience some kind of, force of nature, and it really puts things back in perspective, you know? Anything could happen. And I always say Mother Nature's a serial killer, you know? there's a lot of things we can't control in this world, and we're doing intense damage to our planet right now, and we're seeing the repercussions because of it.
Yeah, that's right. Our planet has changed. I always view it in a geologic sense, so long term, that this we're on a planet that's 4.5 billion years old, and change has always been a part of it. And sometimes that change is accelerated by the species that inhabit it. So there was a species called cyanobacteria that populated the Earth prior to us. And they produced so much oxygen that they went through a mass extinction.
Mm. Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. So these patterns occur. I mean, the warming of the planet has occurred in the Earth's history, and it's been even warmer in the past.
Right. And then cooling periods where.
And cooling, mass extinction, cooling periods. Yeah. So it's always going to change. But I do have hope. Again, I emphasize the hope and renewal and survival aspect. I do think that while we are changing the Earth, there's so many of us populating the planet, we are creating changes. But I do believe that I do hope, and in that way believe that we will adapt and evolve with the changes.
I was going to ask you that exact question, if you were optimistic for the future, and it's good to hear that you are, as a scientist and somebody that, you know, is in touch with the natural world, and as a mom, you know, because I think about what happens to my children, you know, in the future, or my grandchildren. I'm optimistic that we're going to see our way out of this, but obviously, usually there has to be a tipping point, right, where we finally have this wake-up call, and hopefully we do it sooner than later.
Yeah, so throughout our history, we've gone through major setbacks or huge challenges. We're experiencing one right now with the pandemic. And when you use that as a metaphor, our country has experienced that with forest fire too. So there were legendary forest fires in the late 1800s, and that convinced people that fires were too big of a threat for commercial timber supplies. So the United States Forest Service was established in 1905 to provide control to the national forests. And foresters argued, why create national forests if they were going to burn down? So in 1910, there was, again, a big blow up of fires that burned 3 million acres in Montana, Idaho, and Washington in only 2 days. This brought about change. Again, one of those tipping points, something dramatic, drastic that's happening that creates change. They were convinced that fire suppression would prevent this event from occurring again. So the policy became suppress the fire, which created unhealthy forests because there was a huge buildup of fuel in our forests. And that's what also is creating severe forests right now. One of the reasons. And at that time, you know, when they created the suppression policy, they had a limited understanding of the ecological role of fire. In 1944, the Forest Service introduced the character Smokey the Bear. Do you remember Smokey the Bear?
Oh, yeah.
I do.
Oh, yeah.
You're talking to two old guys, so.
Well, I remember Smokey the Bear. So Smokey the Bear said, let's suppress fire. But then during the 1960s, scientific research demonstrated the positive role that fires play in forest ecology. And in the early 1970s, Forest Service changed their policy and let fires burn when and where appropriate. This led to the early 1970s radical change in Forest Service policy. So now we have a different, more educated view of fire, but we're still figuring it out, you know?
Yeah.
So the same thing with the pandemic and other natural disasters. We don't know everything about our planet. As that information becomes available, we can make better decisions, but we're all still learning.
Yeah. And I think some of that unknowing creates this whole, you know, where people just don't believe, you know, and So you get this, the group that believes in the science and wants to make change. And then you have a group that doesn't believe in the science and pushes that we don't make change. And they're looking at it from their own perspective. But somewhere along the line, we, these two extremes got to come together. And I'm hoping it's more on the science side where we can get a better understanding of it and start trying to impact or at least control as much as we can. And maybe this 2020 is an extreme year, but my God, from murder hornets to ash falling from the sky to, you know, everything. So interesting.
It's been a tough year. And I think with such drastic change in such a short period of time, it is creating civil unrest and confusion at the same time. And it is creating more activism and protests. And that's naturally going to occur when everybody's feeling extreme emotions and feeling uncertain. But I think we can use these moments to come together and find ways of improving. The scientists need to work on that vaccine. You know, the our forest ecology, forest fire scientist community need to come together to come up with solutions with the larger community too, because so many factors play into forest fire and the environment. We all need to work together to make a change, or at least in the short term, to help each other cope with this drastic change.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you seem like you've been pretty active in the community since you've arrived in Denver. Do you feel like Denver has been a very welcoming community as far as the art community is concerned?
I find Denver welcoming. I came from, I spent time in New York when I went to school there, and I would go into the city a lot and go to galleries and museums, and that art community is so vast and so amazing. But because it's so vast, it's hard to get to know people, you know, in the community. And I feel like it's a lot faster and easier here in Colorado because it is a smaller community. And I have felt like there are so many amazing artists, shapers and movers in the community that are doing incredible things. And I'm really excited to be a part of that. There's always ways to improve. Gentrification is a huge issue in Denver, and it's really squeezing out some incredible artists in our community. And it's also making it hard for some directors to have a gallery.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, you have a solo show at this gallery where you have representation. How has the pandemic affected the gallery? And what kind of things are you doing to facilitate a show now that you don't have like a big opening night and maybe a closing night? What kind of things are you doing for the show?
So we are offering private viewings during, in general, the gallery's normal hours. So people are welcome to contact me or Sandra Phillips. Sandra Phillips, the director of the gallery, and schedule a private viewing. And then I try to be there every time so that I can provide feedback to, or I provide answers to questions and explain what the show's about and talk about the work in a more in-depth way, which I actually have found pretty valuable. I do love opening receptions. They're fabulous. It's like a big party, you know, and it's fun to see everybody all on that one night and have this really celebratory moment. But at the same time, when there's so many people coming to the event, I miss people and I don't get to have those in-depth conversations with them on an individual basis, which I'm able to do now with the private viewings. I do know that other galleries in town have different approaches to safely viewing the work. So some of them are having opening receptions and some of them are having artist talks using a Sign Up Genius format where you can fill your name in and they can really make sure that the numbers are good per hour, that they work within the rules per hour. But at Sandra Phillips, the private viewings are very rewarding.
So how many people can come to a private viewing? If you, like, if you have a family, can you bring 3 or 4 people, or is it?
Yeah. So numbers depend on how large the gallery is. And okay. Sandra Phillips is a beautiful, cozy, intimate space. So we, our capacity is 5 people, which includes me and Sandra Phillips. So, and then we can have 3 other people, or, other people. Three other people in at a time. And so we just are really good about scheduling everybody in, and which means that, you know, we have a lot of viewings in general because they're so spaced out.
So Jim Gaffigan's going to have to leave half his family at home.
This sounds really enjoyable. I mean, it's an intimate visit with an artist that you wouldn't normally get unless, you know, there's a scheduled talk on a particular night or what have you. Do you see this even after the pandemic ends, like being part of the fabric of what galleries do?
It is a lot of time, but it's totally worth it. And I would totally do it again. Yeah.
Now, since you've been doing this, have you seen any difference in, like, say sales? As far as art is concerned?
Oh, that's a good question. It's so hard to know because there's so many variables. The show has sold well. I'm okay. Happy with the sales. I don't know if the sales are impacted by the pandemic. I'm not sure. Either way, it has led to beautiful conversations and wonderful ideas that are shared with me that I get inspired with for future work. So I have had a couple commissions as a result and sales with the show.
So it's worth it just for the conversations and the connection that you're making with people. And that's the reason I asked that question, because we've talked to a lot of different people and they feel like having a connection with the potential art buyer is really important. And from the flip side, the art buyer wants to know about the artist. And so having this intimate experience with you in this, you know, cozy gallery, I was just curious how that worked. And, you know, if you felt like having that more intimate connection led to better sales. That's where I was going with that.
Yeah, it has led to, like I said, a wonderful exchange of ideas and in-depth conversations and a more rich experience in terms of connection. I feel like right now people are really, really wanting more connection, and they have felt deprived of being able to look at art because for a period of time, the galleries were closed, the museums were closed. And art is a way of coping and processing emotions. And it's a visceral way of getting in touch with your inner memories and deeper thoughts, and also a sense of joy with being able to escape into the color, the shapes, the textures that you simply just love looking at. So being able to open the gallery and being able to be there to see people and invite them in has been very rewarding. And the conversations that we've had have made changes in my outlook of the art and also of what I plan to create. And so there was a little bit more disconnection and detachment with the way I think it was set up before in some ways, because I just came in for the opening reception and I couldn't see everybody because there were too many. And then also for the artist talk, I provide the talk, but then there isn't that as much of that one-on-one dialogue. So I think it's been a really wonderful healing process in all of this to visit with people and experience the art together, but at a safe distance with masks.
So do you kind of look at this, especially this fire show that you're putting on, do you kind of look at it as environmental advocacy in your approach?
Yeah, it's environmental advocacy. I see myself as an artist and someone who loves science going into these areas and documenting what I see. But then obviously it gets changed and altered by what I love. Mm-hmm. And that is, again, that power of survival, regeneration. So yeah,
No, that's cool. And then another question I have, because, you know, we're so used to seeing art as very colorful or, you know, use of color, and the fact that you use charcoal, very monochromatic, obviously. And I'm a photographer, and I've always been attracted to black and white photography as over color, just in my personal view. So have you been getting a good reception from people that look at your art and say, oh my gosh, you know, it's, you know, I looked at it and couldn't believe it was, first of all, I couldn't believe it was charcoal. But getting beyond that, I mean, the fact that it's monochromatic, has that surprised people and people embracing that? Or
I've done the monochromatic approach since the beginning. So since I started developing this series in 2007. And initially, when I described it to some people, they said, oh, no color? People aren't going to want to see it. There's no color. I just did it anyways, because you have to follow what's in your heart. You just got to do it. If you really believe in it, just push through and do it. And I haven't had that response of where's the color? People have taken to the drawings, I think, because I include so much variation of value. And in that way, it becomes colorful.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it works with the concept, because when you go into a fire zone, where's the color?
Right.
It becomes more monochromatic. And so that representation follows in line with that viewing experience of a burn zone. But also, as I explained before with heat wave, when you take the reds, yellows, and oranges out, it starts to look like a different material. It looks like plants or water or other materials. And so it doesn't feel as threatening, which emphasizes the creative aspects of fire. We have to go through these events. It's a part of the natural cycle. We have to experience them on an annual basis. We can't escape that. But what we can do is find ways of coping and allowing ourselves to view the beauty that happens and after the fire, and hold on to that aspect. It's true what Todd said earlier in terms of nature being kind of that force that can take life away, but it also very much creates. And it's not just fire that does this. There's any natural phenomena can do this. Water, you know, can have that effect. Air, earthquakes. There's so many natural phenomena that do this, but that are a part of our earth and an important part. So it makes you, again, you know, view the whole in a larger sense, like what is the larger purpose for this? And the same thing, you know, can apply to pandemic. We're experiencing such devastation, which we all will suffer with and continue to suffer with. But I think the light at the end of the tunnel is then again, realizing that viruses are a part of life, and there's so many viruses that are needed in order to allow life to thrive. So there's a larger hopeful aspect to it all.
I love that you find beauty in this environment where most people, you know, especially this summer, they're complaining about the fires, the smoke, and, you know, ash, whatever. But you create these beautiful pieces of this thing that's so powerful, this, you know, force of nature. When they come to the show, in addition to these charcoals, they're going to see some of your watercolors as well. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. I have two watercolor paintings in the exhibition. And the watercolors feature Colorado species. Obviously, some of the species migrate, so they're in other states too. But that's my more abstract work. I take containers and put watercolor and water in there and mix it up, and then I just pour it. And so I'm pouring the watercolor and it's mixing in interesting ways, and then it takes 4 days to dry completely, so it continues mixing. I don't know what it's going to look like until it's dry.
Wow.
And so what it ends up creating is this abstract shape with muted and bright colors and interesting textures that sometimes involve the watercolor peeling off. into a pattern. And they become metaphors of deconstructed tree trunks. So I view these burned tree trunks as deconstructed by fire, the flames, and weathering processes. And so they become my abstract forms. And then I populate them with symbols of hope from the forest. So in the exhibition, I have a woodpecker on one of the stumps, and woodpeckers love burn zones because they're drawn to the bugs, and the bugs are eating all of the fallen trees, all the wood. And so you'll see a lot of woodpeckers in these areas. And then I have a fritillary butterfly with, and its common name is Earth Mother, which I love. You can find a ton of these butterflies. You know, I saw a ton of fritillary butterflies this summer. And then I also have a baby bristlecone pine, and the bristlecone is known to be a very, very old pine. And so I included a baby growing from that abstracted tree trunk, again, to push that sense of renewal. The other tree trunk includes a lazuli bunting, which is a beautiful blue bird that's named after a blue stone called lapis lazuli. People have used the blue stone to grind down into pigment and have turned it into paint. And this is what the bird is named after because of that brilliant blue color. It also has a scarlet mallow, which is a beautiful orange-red flower that I've seen growing in between sidewalks. It's a resilient one. And it's packed with nutrients that grazing animals love to eat. And then I also put a painted lady butterfly on the stump. So I love exploring our many amazing species in Colorado. We have so many that inspire me. I think I have a lifetime of birds and butterflies and trees and other species to create, to paint and draw.
Yeah. So I got to ask, this is kind of a weird question maybe, but how did you come up with the idea of mixing watercolor in water and then pouring it on the canvas? Is that something that you were exposed to, or is that just something that kind of happened accidentally, or?
Probably multiple reasons. And I pour it onto paper, onto printmaking paper. So I grew up with watercolor pours on my wall as a child. And so I think 18 years of seeing the watercolor pours really got in my head, and I wanted to make my own version because I loved the way the colors just blended together. And then another reason is I watched my daughter create these amazing splashes and raw marks on paper. And I just love the freedom that she had and the confidence. And when she would make these pieces, I'd be like, these are masterpieces. And I'd show people and they'd be like, what? But to me, they were like masterpieces, beautiful, raw, emotive, freeing pieces. And so I just had to make my watercolor pour.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. And the reason I asked that is, like, I would have never even thought of that. I don't think so. The fact that you're doing something a little different than what I've seen in the past, you know, and I'm sure there's variations of this or whatever, but it's really cool. And it does really have a really neat effect of, I can definitely see what you're saying with the deconstructive of the trees, you know, it really has a really decomposing almost look to it. And it's really beautiful. I like those. I'm looking at the prairie wobbler. And that's just a beautiful piece.
Thank you. I love making them. I love painting and using all the colors and exploring those species. So,
yeah, and these are large pieces. This is 36 by 25. The warbler was, the prairie warbler is 36 inches by 25 inches. So they're fairly significant size too. So
for me, it's mid-sized.
Yeah.
Yeah, not.
So what's the larger end that you work in?
Every piece is unique to the composition that I'm creating. So I never use standard sizes.
Okay.
I just create the sizes based on if it needs to be a square because of what I'm drawing, the composition, the design. But the larger ones might be like 80 inches I have one in my studio that's going to be 8 inches long, but I really want to make an even longer piece.
Yeah.
A very, very long fire abstraction. Yeah. I like working with all sizes, tiny to very large.
And what's your small size ones that you've worked on typically?
The smallest is 2 by 3 inches.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
I don't know why that surprised me, but I was like, wow, two by three. Yeah,
that's pretty
small.
When
we're talking, yeah. So when you're working on these large pieces, are you laying on the floor to draw these pieces? How do you work on that scale?
I work on the wall.
Oh, on the wall. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I do like working on a table, but it kind of bothers my neck. So I gravitate towards the wall, but if it's a teeny tiny piece, sometimes I'll just, work on it on a table. The work is very labor intensive. So I have to make sure that I'm in a comfortable position while creating the drawing because I draw for long hours with repetitive motions.
Now, the reason I asked you that is because we interviewed an artist earlier in our doing this podcast, and he would lay on the floor. In fact, when I called his wife to set the appointment, she was like, I need to go talk to him. Hold on. I think he's downstairs laying on the floor drawing. And I don't know how old Leo is. I'm going to guess he's late 70s, wouldn't you say, Wes?
Yeah, mid-70s maybe.
Yeah, I was imagining this older gentleman like lying on the floor drawing just like you would if, like when you're a kid. So I don't know why I got that visual in my mind, but I had to ask that.
Well, and I do pour on the ground. So that's the one time I'll go to the ground. Usually I work with the wall. It's good to change it up though, really, so that your body is shifting in different ways because of the labor intensive process.
Yeah, you probably have to pace yourself or move from doing small increment to maybe bigger strokes or whatever, just to.
Yeah, like yeah. And that's probably a part of some of my size changes. This one took me 6 months. Oh, it's time to do something that takes 2 weeks.
Right. Wow.
Yeah, and then changing the medium is good too because it changes up that rhythm also, which is good for the body and the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So just like most artists that we talk to, you have multiple pieces going on at any given time? No.
No, I work on one at a time.
Wow.
Yeah.
So have you ever found yourself stuck in one place and set it aside and go on to something else?
I only do that if I have a deadline.
Okay.
And I have to abandon to go back to it after I finish the work for the deadline.
Right.
Because the work, it does take a long time, and every piece is unique, so I don't know exactly the time span that it'll take me. So if I've predicted wrong and the piece is taking a lot longer, I have to abandon it temporarily to finish another piece for a deadline. Sometimes that happens. But usually I'm able to work on one piece at a time and finish it. I have to work really efficiently too.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Especially if one takes 6 months, you got to be like on it. Yeah. Well, we had one artist that talked, sometimes he would just set it aside because he'd come to a place where like he was stuck. And then, so he'd put it off the side and maybe 6 months later he'd pick it up and then it would just like magically work itself out. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. My process is different, but my process of coming up with ideas is the same.
And what's the process for that, if you can share?
Well, so I come up with ideas and sometimes they're really not good. Or sometimes I really question it and I'm like, I can't do this right now because I'm not sure. So then I'll let maybe sometimes years pass and then I revisit it because I'm ready and I've come up with that solution for the idea.
So let's talk about that. Did you just kind of like remember it, or is something like you had written down or you started and then you put it aside, or like, do you sketch out an idea? Is that kind of how your process works, or?
I come up with ideas a lot and rapidly, especially when I'm working slow, it feels rapid because then the ideas kind of accumulate after 6 months and I have 10 new ideas and I can't get to all of them. And some ideas are stronger than others. So that's when I'll let the ideas that are not as strong to sit and wait. And I might pick them up several years later, or I might just decide this is not a good one and just leave it.
So when you say you come up with ideas, how formulated are the ideas in the sense that are they just ideas in your head and you're still trying to work it out, wrap your head around it, that kind of idea?
Yeah, I am not. I don't work heavily in a sketchbook.
Okay. I think that's what I was trying to figure out. Yeah, because I could see where, let's say writers have an idea and they write it down, they kind of drop off or write out a synopsis or whatever, and they're like, yeah, this doesn't work. And they have something to refer back to because they wrote it something out. So if you're not sketching it out,
Well, it's true. Writers do that. And I do write it.
Okay.
I have my very long, I have notes that I keep.
Okay.
Yeah. And I just collect things that inspire me, quotes and information and sometimes ideas, but usually the good ones stick in my, in my mind. And I work them out through months or weeks or years. Yeah. To figure out the composition or how it's going to work out the best.
Right.
Yeah.
So I do, I've done a lot of layout and design work and for a nonprofit I used to work for. And there would always be an idea in my head and I would have to work it out first and then put it aside and then the real one would appear after that. But I couldn't get beyond this thing that was like stuck in my head. So I'd have to work it out first and that freed me to do the others. Do you have that kind of same experience or am I just weird?
No.
Well, I'm weird, but maybe not because of that, but no, I'm just kind of curious. You know what I'm saying though?
No, wait, tell me one more time.
So let's say I lay out for an annual report and something gets in my head and I cannot get beyond that piece in my head, that look without, and then, but I, when I do it, I look at it and go, well, this isn't what I want. And then once I'm done with that, it frees me up to do different ideas. But in the moment, I had to work that one out. Does that make sense?
For some reason, my brain isn't wrapping around.
Yeah. Well, that's all right. I mean,
so you let go of an idea and that frees you to
have better ideas. Better like I lay ideas. This one out and I know this isn't like, I'm like, but it's stuck in my head and I have to work it out and then I can put it aside and then maybe variations of that will come out. But I am so stuck in this one idea and I can't just sit there and think of something totally different. I got to work it out first. And then the better work comes. It's kind of funny that like this crappy work comes first and then beyond it is all the good stuff. I don't know.
Sometimes I have that with titles. Titles can be really hard. And I just have this running list of titles. And most times I'm so picky that I just don't use it. It takes a long time to find one.
Right.
Unless it just comes to me when I'm working on the piece and it just is free flowing like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, sometimes you just got to brainstorm deep until you find the core of the idea of what you love. And then you can embellish that and manifest it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. So it's, one of my favorite things is creating ideas. I love that. And I like creating ideas for all different kinds of things, future inventions.
Oh, wow.
Or like show ideas that bring in social justice issues or environmental, as well as my own artwork. Yeah. I love coming up with projects for students.
Right.
I love that. So
the creative process in you is really strong then. Just that it's almost overpowering. It looks like I'm almost the opposite. There's sometimes when somebody will say to do something and I'm just like, I have nothing here. But if I can get with a group of people or whatever and talk it out or with somebody else and talk through it, then the creative juices start flowing. But if I was to sit in my own devices in a bubble, it's going to be painful. So that's so cool for you. I mean, the fact that you love that, you know, creating inventions and working out social justice ideas. I mean, that's all fascinating, but it's all this deep and maybe I'm making a bigger deal out of it than it really is, but holy smokes, you must have a ton of like creative juices just constantly flowing. That's what it sounds like.
I think everybody has lots of creative juices flowing, but in different ways, because creativity can manifest in so many ways for people. And it's not necessarily the traditional drawing, painting way. It can be writing. It can be playing music or knowing about cars or whatever it is, that passion, that drive that you have to get creative with whatever you love. I think you're right. it's probably true, because it is so overpowering that I don't think a lifetime is enough.
Right.
And my poor family, you know, all my creative ideas, which they have fun with, because we do so many creative projects with my kids, and I make things for them. You know, books but I do love what I do, and I do tend to get very focused with it because I want to see through as many ideas as I can. Again, right. I kind of have a fatalistic point of view sometimes. Like, you just don't know how much time you have left. So you've got to take the day and make it the most. Obviously, you need to sometimes then take the day and make the resting and relaxation the most.
Right.
You know, you can.
Well, and I think that's part of it. I think that's just a healthy balance, right?
Yeah.
How do you strike that balance? Let me ask you that.
I don't think there's a balance. I mean, there's a fictitious balance.
Mm-hmm.
The balance is like a seesaw. It's sometimes going up, sometimes going down. It's just, to me, it's too utopian to view that there's that balance.
Right.
So when you start to get off balance, then you go the other direction. And I think when you experience different phases in your life, the balance is also tricky. So I was a full-time professor for many years at Metropolitan State University. And I love teaching. And I had a fabulous time co-coordinating with a friend of mine, Suzanne Mitchell, there. And I was also working full time as an artist. I had my husband then, and I have my husband now. And so I have my personal life. I have my career, which is partitioned into teaching and art. And the balance is tricky.
Right.
It just is. And then I moved on to another phase in my life with having kids. Mm-hmm. And then the balance shifted again.
Right.
And each shift is wonderful in its own way. I think the kids have especially opened me up and made me experience the joy of life and given me so much purpose in life that they really help to fulfill me as an artist and as a human being. And again, that balance is tricky, but you spend lots of time with the kids and then it's time to get back in the studio.
Right.
And you just seesaw kind of your way through. Yeah.
So would you say that you're good at time management?
Probably. Otherwise, I don't think I could do so much.
Right. Yeah.
And you know, as organizing large scale exhibitions, creating a solo exhibition, being a mother, being a wife, being just a human being with needs as well, you know, all of that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't think that I would be as happy without any one of those things. So I use my time efficiently so I can really do all of those things. And they're all rewarding and worth it.
Yeah.
I want to kind of go back to the creativity thing one more time before we move on. Did you always have a vivid imagination? Like when you were a child, were you always creating stuff and doing things? Was that really encouraged when you were a child? Were your parents encouraging that sort of thing? Or was that something that just happened on its own?
No, I was always creating. My mom always had paper and pencils and crayons out. And my sister was very into art. She still is. She's an art conservator. She is head of the lab at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Wow. And she's amazing at what she does, and she's always been an inspiration to me. So one of my earliest memories of creating art is her teaching me how to draw a dog. And she did it with the circles. And I realized, oh my gosh, you just put like five circles together and it starts to look like a dog. I can do this. So we were always making art together. She was a huge inspiration to me as well, because she's always had a unique way of viewing life. And being the younger sister, I always looked up to her. One of the things that I said a lot was me too. You know, oh gosh, that's become a different term now.
Yeah, no, I know what you're saying though.
But yeah, I wanted to do everything that she did. Right. And in that way, I started to view life through her eyes and the ways that she viewed life so uniquely. She really saw those moments where you have this typical scene of flowers, but no, she was noticing the shadows and other really beautiful, different moments that really got you to think. So she inspired me to view life in that way and to love art. My parents were very accepting towards art too, so they always embraced my career. And we saw a lot of museums and art museums and galleries. And yeah, so they were very supportive.
Earlier, before we kind of went backwards there with that question, you were talking about being a professor at Metropolitan State University. You've continued to be involved in art education. Tell our listeners some of the things that you do now.
So I teach at the Denver Art Museum, drop-in drawing. I've been doing that since 2013. And it's a lot of fun. Prior to the pandemic, we would go into the museum and explore a different theme. We meet on the second Tuesday of the month from 1 to 3 p.m. At the museum, we provide materials and we get to explore and get immersed in these amazing masterpieces that are really celebrated at the museum and in our community. Since the pandemic, we've gone virtual. So all of our programs this year, again, that second Tuesday of the month from 1 to 3 are remote and done through Zoom. And we have a fabulous time doing those Zoom sessions too. So we get to create from the comfort and privacy of our homes. You get to choose whatever material you want to work with. And we explore a theme. I introduced the theme with artwork from history and from contemporary times. And we also have been highlighting a local artist that we invite based on that theme. So you get to see the local artist demonstrate a technique. You also get to visit their studio. And I also include additional techniques, demonstrations so you can learn more ways of creating art. Sometimes they're drawing, sometimes they're alternative processes.
Wow. That sounds fantastic. And so there's no cost involved then, right?
It's free.
Yeah. It's free.
Mm-hmm. Any age group?
Any ability, any age group, anyone can come and join us.
And how do they find that or find you?
So you can find the Zoom link on the Denver Art Museum website. Okay. Just by Googling Denver Art Museum, drop-in drawing. And we have a page on that site with the link in the description of the theme and what we're doing that day.
That's awesome. That's really neat that you're continually doing it through the pandemic, and how Zoom really just like feeds itself for that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And it really helps us connect during these difficult times. And so it's fun. It's a fun time to create together while learning more about art and learning some new techniques. Yeah.
Yeah. That's so cool.
Yeah, and you don't have to drive. You can just click the link and there you are. Yeah.
I could be out there in your pajamas.
You can. Some people choose to experience drop-in drawing by, you know, clicking their video on. And some people want to maybe stay in their pajamas They keep their video off, although we don't mind pajamas. That's okay. you can click your video off and your mute button and just watch and experience it. So that's been a lot of fun. I'm so happy that we were able to continue that program because it's the highlight of my month. I love doing it.
Sounds like a lot of fun. I'm going to have to check it out. Sounds like something you would enjoy, Wes.
It would. Especially if I could wear my pajamas.
You have to call in sick that day.
Yeah, yeah. Or I could just sit in my office, close the door, and go in a meeting.
There you go.
And sit there and draw.
Do you do workshops as well?
Yeah, I do workshops. Sometimes I'm a visiting artist for schools. So I do a variety of things. I sometimes do extra programs for the Denver Art Museum too, that aren't drop-in drawing, but within a different theme. I just did a workshop at the Art Students League of Denver, and that was a lot of fun.
And it was that the first time that you've done that for them?
It was for them. Yeah. Yeah. It was an experimental watercolor and the natural world workshop. So we were blowing bubbles with soap and watercolor, and we were using rubbing alcohol to create interesting patterns and salts and approaching it in different ways to explore texture and pattern and color.
That so sounds cool. Like fun.
Yeah, it was fun.
Well, and seeing that would lead into more creativity. I could see we're doing little projects like that, just like your brain starts being more creative and thinking outside the box and going down little rabbit holes and of fun exploration.
Yeah. Yep. That's my brain.
It's a beautiful brain though. It's a beautiful brain.
Talk about these projections that you do.
Okay. So I started the projection series, years ago, and I'll usually create one or two projections a year. The ones that I created in the exhibition, I'll describe first in light first. It's a drawing of an hourglass. I bought an hourglass that fit the vision of the one that I had in my mind. And then I used that as a reference to create the drawing. It's a charcoal drawing, and I enlarged it. So it's way larger than life. I was thinking about time as a metaphor because it's pretty critical in so many ways. When it comes to fire, how long does it take to contain the fire? When it comes to the pandemic, time is heavily on our minds. How long is this going to last? And when will the vaccination be created? So I was creating this right at the start of the pandemic. It's called First in Light because it's named after an Emily Dickinson poem that's about fire. Her poems, the title of it is Ashes Denote That Fire Was. And it got me thinking first in light about the beginning with the Big Bang and the sun bringing, you know, helping life to thrive on Earth, and how fire's been a critical part of our survival, using its warmth, using it to cook food, etc. So it really made me think of fire as such a critical part of our lives. The other thing is that an hourglass is in the shape of infinity if you turn it on its side.
Right.
So yeah. It has this interesting way of, you can turn it over and time begins again. When I drew it, I captured the sand falling in time. So it never runs out, which comforted me. And then I created that fire projection to, again, bring that first in light idea, as well as wildfire, into the piece. And the fire projection is on a loop. So it never stops if the loop keeps going. And again, it inspired me with thinking about time as a flexible thing, but also cyclic and patterned. And that became really prominent in my mind, especially using time-based media on a time-based piece. So the projection was really a challenge. I kept on trying it in different ways and it didn't work. And then I'd come up with new ideas until finally I came up with a projection that I really felt like it matched my vision and the narrative for the piece. I created an animation. First of all, there's fire, there's flames above on the sand part that's in the upper half of the hourglass. And then there's the animation part are the falling embers of the fire that follow the line of the sand that goes to the bottom of the hourglass. So fire is woven throughout the composition from the top to the bottom. And to me, these are performance pieces. This is how I create a performance.
Yeah.
I take my drawing, which can stand on its own, and then I make it, and then I animate it as the performance during the exhibition.
That's fantastic. I cannot wait to see it.
Thanks. The other projection piece is called Unfurl, and it was inspired by a storm that I experienced at Pike National Forest. Pike National Forest is near Deckers, Colorado, and that's where the Hayman Fire occurred in 2002. And the Hayman Fire has now been replaced. It used to be the largest fire in Colorado's recorded history, and now it's Pine Gulch. I've been going back to this Hayman Fire Zone for many years now. And the storm that I witnessed had lightning, and it really inspired me to create a piece with lightning because lightning is such a critical part of the fire cycle. Yet it is also an essential part of the nitrogen cycle on Earth, providing macronutrients like nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium that plants use to thrive. So it has this really interesting destructive and constructive relationship with nature. So in the piece, I have this really large brewing storm with a blackened landscape below. There's some live pine trees and some tree remnants. There's a silhouette of a deer as well. And I have a projection of lightning in the landscape. I wanted to make it a projection because lightning moves so fast and it really lights up the landscape. And I wanted to create that effect in the drawing. If I instead drew a still of the lightning, it wouldn't have that pace. It would be, you know, a longer viewing experience. And so the projection, again, has that quicker pace that makes a more realistic viewing of a storm.
You have two of these projections in the solo exhibit right now, in addition to the watercolor and the charcoals.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also video that you've incorporated with this solo exhibit, or is that part of it as well?
Yeah, I have time-lapse.
Time-lapse, okay.
Yeah, so I go into Pike National Forest once a year. In the past, sometimes twice. I program a camera to take photos every 5 minutes, and it's connected to a large battery, and I put it all in a weatherproof mailbox with plexiglass in front, so it really is weatherproof because the storms do come through. And then I camouflage it with bark and material that's around it because these are public, these are spaces where anybody can walk in and find it. And I don't want my equipment to be taken. The camera's an SLR.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I want to keep my equipment. So
yeah,
I camouflage it. And then I come back 2 weeks later to see I captured. Yeah. And so I have three of these time-lapse videos on view at the gallery from 3 years, starting in, 2018, 19, and 2020.
So every 5 minutes it's shooting a frame. Is that what you said?
It is. Yeah. Yeah. So I get thousands of photos that look through to see if I captured any wildlife because sometimes it's just one frame with the mm-hmm. wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So the one that I did this year, I set it up on a cliff looking down at aspen trees. Aspen trees are adapted to fire. So they have extra water in their trunks. So when a fire goes through a landscape, sometimes they stop it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
I did not know that. Yeah, as long as it's not too severe of a fire.
Right, right.
And then if they haven't had fire, sometimes the larger pines will take over.
Hmm.
And then if a fire does go through the landscape, then the aspens send out lots and lots of saplings to start again.
Yeah, because they're a tree that's actually all the different aspens are one single species, right?
Yeah, they're a family, right?
Or a family. Clone?
Clone. They clone. Oh. So
okay.
So aspens can be considered one of the largest organisms
right. On
Earth. Because sometimes this massive grove of aspens is one.
Right.
It clones itself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that is really fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah. It really is.
I mean, it's just weird.
It's weird.
Because yeah. We just look at them and they're trees, but, you know, they've cloned themselves and it's one piece or one whatever. I don't know. I can't find the word.
It's like that kind of reminds me of the Borg. I love sci-fi.
Okay.
Yeah. Borg, just cloning. Like but, you know, they're really cool too because they have that fungal system underneath it. Allows them to communicate, you know. So on one end of the aspen grove, it's drought warning, or there's an insect eating me. So they collectively, again, the Borg, they collectively know, you know, oh, we better prepare or help wow. Each other with this pest that's come in or the drought. They're really, trees are amazing. They really are.
Yeah. That is bizarre, isn't it? I just find that just absolutely fascinating. I'd heard the cloning thing many years ago, but I didn't know they collected extra water in the trunk and could, you know, theoretically stop certain levels of wildfire. Did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah. They're adapted to fire and they're really amazing right now.
Yeah.
It's September and almost October, it's peak.
So do you know because obviously you know a lot about aspen, do you know what causes the peak colors? Is there, because there's a formula to it, isn't there? So much rain at a certain time or?
Yeah, it's influenced by precipitation, but I don't know it.
Oh, okay.
I'd have to check that one.
Because it's funny because like in the Black Hills here up in South Dakota, I was driving around and, you know, some of the trees are just, they went from green to brown and they're just like done. And then you'll have these little spurts of just beautiful aspen yellows and, you know, some oranges and stuff. But it just makes me go, wow, why you guys didn't turn really pretty, but... Yeah, I know there's like a formula. I heard it like on CBS Sunday Morning, like 15 years ago or something. Somebody was explaining they were in like, you know, upstate Maine or something. And they were talking about, you know, precipitation at certain times of the year or, you know, or towards the end. I don't remember, but yeah, I was hoping you did. So anyway, I'll have to Google it.
I know, me too. So we can figure out the formula and know.
Yeah.
I did see some orange leaves, mostly yellow, but I went to Georgetown.
Oh, well, that's
Sunday.
They got some beautiful aspens there in that area.
Yeah, yeah.
So how is it? Is it turning now? Is it good time? Or are we still a couple weeks out before peak? Or
it was amazing. To me, it looked like peak. Okay. Obviously, it changes with elevation, the peak.
Right. Peak and how high you are in the longitude, too. Mm-hmm, I don't remember. Mm-hmm. I think northern's peak earlier than the southern regions, I think. I think it kind of goes north to south, if I remember right. Would make sense, but yeah, I think I'm about a week away. I think 4 to 5 days we'll be peaking here. So anyway.
Yeah.
I love it. It's fun. Autumn is my favorite time of year. So I'm glad I'm talking to you right now.
Yeah.
So on a talk, go ahead.
Oh no, you go.
Go Todd, go.
Rock, paper, scissors. Talk to us about this whole pink progression, how it came into being and what it's all about.
Yeah. So pink progression happened after the Women's March. So I witnessed thousands, as well as everybody witnessed thousands of people coming out to protest. And it wasn't just in the country, it was worldwide. And I was just amazed with that. And I wanted to see it continue. I know a lot of people were like, will this momentum continue? And I did want to keep the momentum going in our art community specifically, because that's my expertise. So I asked a bunch of my artist friends, would you create art for a show if it was on the color pink to commemorate this amazing event? And they all said yes. And so it grew from there. So the whole concept was, pink became a controversial color. So it became a color that we could discuss and explore in the exhibition. So artists were invited to use it or reject it. And both experiences happened, which was good. Some people rejected it. A lot of people used it. And what I was hoping would happen is they'd use it in so many different ways. So there were deep, dark, beautiful pinks or reddish tones, you know. And there were very light pinks and there were orangey ones. There were so much variety with that color. But it was also accompanied with blues and yellows and other colors. That became our unifying factor in the exhibition. So it ended up growing to over 50 artists in 2018. We had three exhibitions, and pink progression progressed through the year. So it started out with Boulder Public Library, continued on to Denver Public Library, and then our final exhibition that year was at the Center for Visual Art, all in educational public spaces, and each exhibition was unique. So while a lot of the artists created artwork for all three exhibitions, they included different pieces for all three exhibitions. And the largest one was at the Center for Visual Art. And the exhibitions were about many, many issues. Again, when you go to the Women's March, it's not just about feminism. It's about the environment. It's about equality, racial equality, socioeconomic equality, immigration. So many social issues are brought into it. And that was the approach for these shows. Each of the artists could create work about the social issue that they wanted to explore. And they were also invited to create unique work for the show. So I didn't pre-select as the curator and organizer. And I should say one of the curators, Cecily, with the Center for Visual Art, was an amazing curator and organizer also in the exhibition. And then we worked as a group too to curate and install. So pink progression commemorates, celebrates, and builds on the solidarity established during these marches, addressing concepts of human rights, equality, gender identity, and inclusivity. And these exhibitions include all gender identities and expressions. So men and women, LGBTQIA, artists, and all gender identities and expressions, because it takes all of us to make a difference, all of us working together. Progression refers to the hope for progress and the issues that we explore, as well as progressing away from prejudice stereotypes, which again brings into mind pink, which can be a stereotype. But again, it's a very controversial color, so it was really fascinating to explore it within the exhibition. And I've had an interesting relationship with pink too in my past.
Oh, we want to hear about it.
Initially disliking it, because I viewed it as that typical feminine, delicate color. Mm. And then when I had kids, pink totally became something different to me, and it became powerful and joyful. And with the Women's March, reclaiming it also became a powerful act. So I think colors are very subjective, and everybody has their own view of colors based on their own experiences. So I always find it interesting to see what people's favorite colors are or their least favorite colors are and why.
So talk about this current show, because it revolves around collaborations between artists, sometimes not just two, but three, four artists.
That's right. So this year for Pink Progression, we wanted to select a different theme since it's a new year, new time. And we selected the theme collaboration because in order to create social change, we need to work together. Social change doesn't happen with just one person, although there are people that stand out individually that are amazing and really inspire change. But it really takes so many people working with those people, you know, to make a difference and for all of us to work together to make a difference. So the exhibition used collaboration as a metaphor for social change. And it also is in conversation with 2020 being the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which is guaranteeing and protecting women's right to vote. And it commemorates this milestone. It also raises awareness of racial voting inequities and the complex struggle for universal suffrage today. So in the exhibition, you'll find a mix of reactions. Some people who are, you know, we have a whole group of artists who created a big cake. So that's Martha Russo, Tina Suzinski, Anna Suzinski, and Emma Hardy. They created a big celebratory cake with layers of clothing used in protests throughout history that were then coated in slip, ceramic clay. And then assembled into a large cake with frosting on top. And the cherries are the pink hats.
Nice.
Yeah. And so we also have artists like Tia Anthony and Kimberly Putnam, who created a ceramic corset. So the corset is about women of different races coming together to make a difference. It's got vintage images of protests from the past on top of it with this beautiful silk brown ribbon as the lace component of it. And again, it has that beautiful fragility to it with the ceramic being that corset that a woman has to wear. So it's such a binding material, yet it has this fragility to it and that it could break. Yeah, it's a beautiful piece in the galleries. There's such a big variety of work exploring so many issues in the exhibition.
It sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
And that runs through the first week of November, is that correct?
So that runs through November 8th.
Okay.
And I also wanted emphasize that this show also, a huge part of it was the hard work that Arvada Center exhibition manager Emily Grace King put into it, director of galleries Colin Parson, and Arvada Center staff. They did an incredible job putting together this massive show. It's over 150 creatives from the community, artists, poets, musicians, dancers. And they did it all during the pandemic, which is extremely hard. And the artists also put so much passion and thoughtfulness into their work during a difficult time. So it was hard to collaborate during the pandemic. And they found really inventive, beautiful ways of making it work and creating their pieces to inspire connection in all of us during these challenging times.
Now, did you guys come up with this concept of collaboration pre-pandemic, or is this something that you pivoted once the pandemic happened and you knew that the show was coming up?
No, it was all done pre-pandemic. Okay. So large-scale shows like this are usually in the works a year or more in advance.
Yeah. Where's this show at?
It's at Arvada Center.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really appreciate the fact that you guys are recognizing the anniversary of women's suffrage, because we often take that way too for granted. You know, we just assume everybody can vote, but that's not the case. And it's still not the case. And in fact, there's factions working against people with having the ability to vote, whether they're closing down centers in urban cities, reducing the number of polling places for people to go vote. So there's long lines in that instances. You know, there's states that restrict suffrage for felony convictions. Only two don't. And so I think we need to be aware of that. And even though you may be behind bars or you may have a felony conviction, doesn't mean you're not an American citizen. You should have a right to vote. So that's my political stance for tonight. But I do appreciate the fact that you're bringing recognition to that, because I think it's so important and we take that stuff so much for granted. So
yeah, we for the exhibition, we had a couple additional creative projects, one opening up to the community. When we create these shows, it's important to make the exhibition accessible to the larger community, inviting them to create art that's then on view at the show. So for this exhibition, we invited people to submit, to just email, or we have a PO box so they could mail it in, their designs. And then we turned them into buttons. And so we have two large scale walls that are filled with buttons from the community, and then at the end of the show, they can go pick their button up. And we also had two essayists. So we had professor of women and gender studies and author Lorraine Bayard DeVolo, and architecture critic and art critic Mary Bowles Chandler. They created wonderful essays that provided the exhibition with historical context and interpretation. And Lorraine, I love what she had to say in her essay, which is, I really want to quote her here. So we can get more of that historical context when it comes to voting. So although Colorado granted women the right to vote in 1893, it was not until the passage of the 19th Amendment in 1920 that women nationwide were constitutionally enfranchised. Yet this right was not applied equally throughout the nation, and it is still within living memory that women's access to the voting booth broke down along racial lines. By engaging in an intersectional celebration of the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage, we see that although the 19th Amendment toppled a barrier to universal enfranchisement, other barriers remained and still remain. Black women under the 19th Amendment constitutionally had the right to vote. That right was denied to most through such means as literacy tests, poll taxes, intimidation, and violence. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 ended these discriminatory voting practices. For many Latinxes, Asian Americans, Native Americans, and others, the 1975 extension of the Voting Rights Act was a crucial moment. Today, obstacles to the universal suffrage remain. For example, many states prohibit former felons from voting, which disproportionately affects Black men. States' requirements of governmental issued IDs to vote disproportionately inhibits African American and Latinx citizens' access to the voting booth. Strict voter ID laws also present an inordinate burden on trans people who do not identify or present as the gender marked on their ID. And there's more issues that we're still working through to this day. But yeah, it hasn't been that long, 100 years and even less for others, that we have the right to vote. So you can see that we have a lot more work that we need to do.
Well, I appreciate the work that you're doing on that. That's awesome. So thank you.
It's important work to me. And I feel like once I started creating these community installations, again, my life gained more purpose. And I plan on continuing these exhibitions as well. Cool. With Pink Progression, but also I'm hoping to create environmental exhibits in addition.
Fantastic. That's great. Is that something that we could possibly see in the future, like in 2021, something that's environmentally themed?
I'm working on it. Yeah, yeah. And the idea for the environmental exhibit, it would be exploring our environment, but also celebrating nature. Yeah. And I think with these community exhibitions too, while we're bringing up some major social issues as a way to help raise awareness and find solutions, we're also bringing to light more voices and more connections, which is, I think, needed. The more we can talk with each other about our personal experiences, the more we can come together, the more we can come up with ideas that help all of us, because we're all sharing the same habitat.
Yeah.
Animals, you know, the butterflies, the bugs, the birds, all of us on all in all of our countries, we're all sharing the same planet. And I really do think we can find more ways of coming together and working together.
I agree.
Yeah, when you were saying the bugs and everything, it reminded me of that book by Rachel Carson, The Silent Spring, and the work that she did, you know, to her dying day, bringing, you know, it's trying to stop pesticides. And it's so important that, you know, we just, you know, when we're living our life, we don't think about these things. And then they have like these long-term ramifications that we need to, you know, like you said, I think everybody comes to the same place of goodwill, but they come from different perspectives and sometimes they clash and they don't really, maybe a person doesn't even really know how they clash. So bringing it to light and having these conversations and different perspectives brought together to see that we're not really that far apart if we could just communicate.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, even if we have differing opinions, we all were eating, you know, we're drinking, we're surviving. We have our homes, we have our families, we have our work. We all have our human habits that we share in common. We all struggle and we all have challenges, and we can understand each other in those ways and maybe find a middle ground where we can meet together. Yeah, I feel like the country is so divided right now.
It is. It is.
Yeah. Yeah.
But once again, you know, it's divided on lines that, you know, are sometimes hard to understand. But if they step back and realize that we have far more in common and far more goals, you know, common goals, that we shouldn't let these petty differences, but we have, whether it's leaders or media or anything, just feeding the fire and feeding fear. And that's what causes all this. So bringing community art together and having conversations based off that is, I think, is a great way to do it, because it's, once again, you're using art as a metaphor that we can talk about and frame in a way that to bring understanding, I think.
Yeah. And I think that you can proceed in this life working hard and lifting yourself up, but life becomes so much better and filled with more purpose when you can also lift someone else up. And the more people you can lift up, the better.
Yeah.
There's no better feeling in the world than helping others. Mm-hmm. You cannot go to a grocery store and purchase that off the shelf, right? It's just, there's no better feeling. And it makes you feel better. It raises up the community. And until we embrace each other as equals, you know, around the world and raise everybody up, we're not going to progress as a species. We're not going to, you know, we won't see ourselves out of this. But I, like Wes said, what you're doing is important work. You and the other artists that are involved and doing these community art projects, I think it's fantastic.
Thank you. Yeah. And I am looking forward to organizing more shows and having more people included in the exhibitions, because there's so many amazing artists. And when I say artists, I mean also musicians and dancers and writers, et cetera, that are out there that haven't been a part of a show yet and that should be and deserve to be a part of one of the shows, you know, in the future. So I'm hoping that we can continue to work together and make connections in this way and celebrate the beautiful expression of art. And back to Rachel Carson. Rachel Carson is an amazing environmentalist. I love a couple of her quotes. One of them is, "In nature, nothing exists alone." Again, we're in it together. Every single species here, we're all in it together.
We're interconnected. Yeah.
Yeah. And I love viewing it. I think that sometimes the more you can view through someone else's eyes, or wear someone else's shoes, or imagine that you're a worm in the soil, you know, the better.
Yeah.
Because it just opens your mind up and you can experience joy in so many ways by viewing through someone else's joyful experiences, or you can experience the challenges in the same way and understand them in a deeper level. But you've got to move outside of your own kind of tunnel.
Yeah.
And open up to other ways of perceiving. I've got another quote too from Rachel Carson. One way to open your eyes to unnoticed beauty is to ask yourself, what if I had never seen this before? What if I knew I would never see it again? So again, that goes back to that fatalistic point of view. Like, I have today, I need to embrace it. I need to do what I love in this moment. And I think a lot of us are feeling that also with the pandemic. It's making us kind of question our lives and wonder, what is making me happy and what do I want to do that, you know, continues that. But again, it's a struggle for me. It's a challenge. It's not like I'm always viewing life this way, but I try to remind myself the more the better, so that again, I can reach outside of myself and get inspired by other perceptions and by the sublime beauty of nature that surrounds us on a daily basis.
Yeah. And I was, you know, I was kind of feeling doom and gloomy this weekend, and that was part of the driving force of getting me out in nature, because I love to commune with nature, and so driving down this canyon with high canyon walls and the changing of the leaves and lots of pine trees and deer, and it rejuvenates you. And you have to sit there and I did. I consciously thought, wow, what a beautiful day. This is what it's all about. And just embracing that, because we do get so wrapped up in whether it's politics or, you know, dreading, you know, who's going to get sick next or what weird insect like the murder hornet's going to come attack. I mean, you got to just kind of remove yourself from that. And nature is a great way to do that. So, yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it is. I did that also this weekend on Sunday. And I was like, I got to get down on the grass and just watch it move in the wind.
Yeah. Yeah.
And listen to it. Yeah. It's relaxing. It's meditative. And I have a similar experience when I'm drawing in the studio too. I just reach this flow state where I escape time. Well, I don't really escape time.
No.
Hours pass and I'm like, oh no, I've only done an inch.
But in the moment, you're timeless.
Yeah, in the moment, yeah, it's timeless and it's meditative and it's relaxing, and I'm addicted to that process. So I spend hours doing it because it's what I love.
So you're a victim of Einstein's relativity, in the sense that as your body was actually getting old, your inner child was not aging at all because they were wrapped up in the moment of drawing.
Yes. It's like, oh my gosh, I have gray hair now. What happened? But it's true. It's true. When you create, it's kind of a strange concept too, because I think, gosh, I'm creating for, you know, thousands of hours, this piece, and it's just on the wall.
Right.
You know, like, what am I doing? Again, like the questioning, the perceiving in a different way, trying to look outside of yourself and viewing in from an outsider's perspective. But, you know, it's just something I do. It's who I am. And I'm just going to keep doing it because it's what I love. And the cool thing about art is that when you do pass, your art continues to speak for you. It can be expressing different things based on the culture and the time and the event that occurred, but still, it continues on that, you know, fundamental message that you gave it, or those shapes and colors that you gave it. And I love that about it. So it does have kind of that timeless feel, at least more than one generation, which would be my lifetime, you know, more than one lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
It can be really beautiful in that way. The other thing that I really like about it too is that art can be about anything. So if you have lots of interests, you can really work with those many interests and create art about all of it.
Right.
And you can learn so much about art because it's so varied in that way.
Mm-hmm. You just said something that kind of stuck with me. And I, when you said that, you know, when you die or when you leave this plane, the art speak continues to speak for you. And it's interesting. Like, I think it's important to put art in its context of its time and its place for that person, but also to release it to the future generations and let them put meaning behind it. It doesn't even have to be generations down the line. You can paint something and have mean one thing. And then me as the viewer can sit down and look at it and get evoke a different feeling and a different meaning that's unique to me. So that's beautiful about that.
Yeah, it's true. I think after you pass, life, you know, it goes on and society goes through new things, new experiences, new technology, new events, and the artwork, those images you create get reshaped by that. So it does get taken forward and incorporated into the culture in interesting ways. And I don't mind that, giving up control in that way. You know, I won't be around to say, no, it's about this.
Right.
You know, I won't mind because I'm not around. But also, it is, I think it's important for the culture to really associate what they want in within the piece, because it's, again, an expression of what they're going through. So yeah, it's interesting. It's like with the pandemic, I think it's reshaped our perception. So when we see a shape that's like the coronavirus, you know, prior to the coronavirus, we might have been thinking other things. And now we're always going to be thinking, you know, that viral form and our experience. But it can, you know, be the same for a more, you know, uplifting event.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we've talked about this before. It'll be interesting to see how artists perceive this time and what messages they leave metaphorically behind that is their impact from the coronavirus and how they perceive it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And only time will tell.
Yep.
Yeah. Art is a beautiful way of interpreting the times.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Mm-hmm. And the culture.
Let me ask you this question, because we haven't visited this in a couple episodes, and I should have asked this last week when we were talking to Jerry. We've had this discussion with some artists as far as an artist produces this beautiful masterpiece, and then later on it comes out that they weren't a very nice person, or they've done something nefarious. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no right or wrong answer. But, and just as a real basic example, I've used, you know, music. And so Michael Jackson being a musical talent, I love his music, but he may did some not too cool things with kids, right? Does it negate his legacy, his musical legacy, or can you separate the artist from the music? Can you separate the art from the artist? If one artist made the case, I don't know if you know Daniel Sprick, he made the case that if it was good then it's still good now. But we've had varying opinions on this, so I'm always curious. And to get just another artist's perspective on this.
Yeah, that is such a challenging question to ask. I kind of want to view it like a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't negate what they've done. It can never do that. So I think both just continue on into history, known for this incredible music, but also known for this horrible act. It's just the two, not one or the other.
Okay. Good answer. Good answer.
I look at it that way with Kevin Spacey. I loved his movies. And, you know, obviously the things he did that we've heard about is, you know, is not good and should be, you know, punished for it. But by God, I miss Kevin Spacey in movies and what he brings his character to, although he got kind of whacked out with Frank Underhill. But, you know, he just brought something unique. And now we probably won't see that again. And then another good example is my broadcasting hero is Charlie Rose. You know, another case of he had a long, storied career as a, you know, interviewer. And then, you know, his deeds he did with different women in hotel rooms or whatever. And, you know, we won't see him interview anybody else. And man, that just pains me. But it's hard. It is hard to separate. I mean, it's hard to separate what you know about the guy and his art. But at the same time, man, I have to because I enjoy the piece that he did, and it brings something to me, you know, that I, you know, that is meaningful. So anyway, that is it's a great question and hard to ponder.
It is. It's a hard to ponder. And yeah, I think I view it similar to you, Wes. I think that you fall in love with someone, you don't know them entirely, but their image, the way they present themselves, if it's someone in the movies or TV, et cetera, you know, a performer, and you're focused on those aspects. It's not the whole human being that you're looking at. You're just falling in love with those aspects. And you believe it so much that when something happens, it just kind of makes it's just devastating because you're facing this clash of this horror, these awful, disgusting aspects up against these amazing ones. And it's just confusing. And we can just live in that confusion because it's
If anybody wants to know what the definition of cognitive dissonance, that's the feeling. That is the feeling. That's cognitive dissonance.
I love that concept.
Yeah. Because when I was in psychology in college, it was just like, I don't get it. Now I get it because I felt it.
Yeah. I love psychology. My dad is a psychologist.
Oh, really? That's awesome.
Yeah. So he lives and breathes psychology. So he's obsessed with his career, just like I am with my, like, it's our passion. We love to do it and we have to do it. It makes us breathe and feel alive, you know, and it was for him the same way with psychology. But I benefited from that because we would have these long conversations about emotions and the human experience. And he was always great about, you know, ideas of justice and equality and understanding these complex emotions that we're going to feel and we don't have to judge them, that because we all experience them. We can decide how we want to experience them and how we want to present them. Yeah, that's a challenging question, but a good one to pose. Yeah.
Well, thank you for taking the time and answering it. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
It's interesting to hear everybody's, you know, take on it. Obviously, you're very involved with the community and activism, and it plays a role in your art. But what I love about what I've read about you and I've seen on your website is that not only do you talk the talk, but you walk the walk. And a certain percentage of your art sales go to organizations that you feel are in need and that are helping better our world in some way, shape, or form. Can you tell us who those organizations are that you're going to donate proceeds from your art sales this year to?
So I'm donating a percentage of my art sales to American Red Cross and their Western Wildfire section. In particular.
And what all do they help to facilitate that particular aspect of the Red Cross? Just providing resources for people that are in need that have been devastated by fires?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then I also donate a percentage to Colorado State Forest Service.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right on point with your artwork and your donations. What, you know, so it's definitely a passion and feeding that in multiple ways. That's beautiful.
Thank you. I think a lot of organizations are in need right now. So the more we can help, the better.
Yeah.
And I've donated to other environmental organizations too, but those will be my two this year. I'm also thinking about an Australian fund for the devastating wildfires last year, but I need to locate the right one. Yeah.
I bet you have to do a lot of research to find these different organizations and make sure that everything's above board, right?
Right.
You feel comfortable with them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good for you for doing that. I think that's wonderful that you do that. I think we can probably call it an evening, Wes. Do you have any more questions?
No, I bet this has been absolute joy.
Yeah.
And I love your work. It's incredible. Your charcoal work is incredible. And I'm a huge Aspen fan, even bigger now that I've learned some more things about aspens, but your aspens are absolutely gorgeous and just, I'm digging them.
Thank you. Yeah, it was wonderful to spend time with the two of you talking about my work and also getting to know you a little better as well. Thank you for doing this podcast to help promote a community of artists and celebrate artwork and the process of creating.
Is there anything else that you would like to tell listeners that you have coming up either towards the end of this year or into 2021 that you want to talk about before we sign off for the evening?
I have a lot of ideas that I am planning on working, and it's quite a few. So I have some commissions that I'll be working on, a large scale drawing, probably one of the most intricate that I've made yet, which is going to take maybe 6 months or more. I'm also planning on organizing an environmental exhibition and then participating in one too for 2021. Yeah. I love this. I have another quote from John Muir that I'd like to share with you as well. So the quote is, "By forces seemingly antagonistic and destructive, nature accomplishes her beneficent designs, now a flood or a fire, now a flood of ice, now a flood of water, and again in the fullness of time, an outburst of organic life." So I also want to communicate the message of hope that there's so much goodness in this world and amazing beauty and connection. And let's all use that to help us through these challenging times.
I love that.
Yeah, I do too.
I love that message of hope. Thank you so much and bless you for that. That's awesome. Thank you.
Anna, one more time, people that are listening to this can find you via your website. It's annakart.com, correct?
Yep.
And then are you on social media where people can find you? Do you post stuff on Instagram and that sort of thing?
Yeah. So I'm on Instagram and it is at annakart as well.
Fantastic. And I'll make sure that... for our listeners that we have all the information for Sandra Phillips Gallery so they can check out your art in person, make an appointment to do a gallery visit with Anna. And I'll also have the information for the Arvada Center for the Pink Progression show as well. For the Tenet Podcast, I'm Todd Pearson.
And I'm Wes Brown.
Have a great week.